Hello, I'm Gordon Guyatt. I'm a professor of medicine at McMaster University and have been the editor of the JAMA User's Guide to the Medical Literature. I'm here today for JAMA Evidence Podcast. Today we're going to talk about Chapter 13.4 in the User's Guides entitled Surrogate Outcomes. Today's discussion is with Dr. Anne Holbrook from my Department of Medicine at McMaster University in Ontario, Canada. Dr. Holbrook, can you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Gordon. I'm an internal medicine and clinical pharmacology specialist, practice primarily hospital-based medicine, and particularly specialize in patients who are on very complex medication regimens. And I think relevant to surrogate outcomes, I also do a large amount of drug policy work for the federal, provincial, and regional governments.
Starting off, what do people mean by surrogate outcomes?
I think most of the time, clinicians and people interested in research evidence, we're interested in what we would call important clinical outcomes. And those are clinician important. And usually what's clinician important is patient important and vice versa. So things like length of life, how people are functioning, quality of life, you know, in this day and age in COVID times, mental health, all those would be really important. Sometimes you can't measure those for whatever reason. And so a surrogate outcome is used as a substitute for the clinical outcome. And you hope that it's a very good predictor of that clinical outcome. But it's basically something that might be related to the clinical outcome, but is maybe easier to measure. But it's measured instead or in addition to the clinical outcome.
Can you give some examples of surrogate outcomes?
So it's interesting. I was thinking about this today, and any clinical day, any non-clinical day, probably come across a surrogate outcome question at least three or four times. So today I dealt with a question around how well does the INR predict clinical outcomes for anticoagulants, warfarin in particular, the vitamin K antagonist. So it generally predicts the risk of bleeding, generally predicts the risk of thromboembolic events, but it's not a perfect tight relationship, and we use the time and therapeutic range. The example in the chapter uses A1C, which is a great discussion of a surrogate marker that we thought 20, 30 years ago was going to be extremely good and then turned out to have some flaws in terms of predicting what effect the drug was going to have on the real clinical outcomes that eventually came out. Blood pressure is basically a surrogate outcome. I keep telling patients it's not the blood pressure that we're really interested in, but a blood pressure is, in a way, a predictor of how well you're going to do in terms of avoiding a heart attack or a stroke. And in cancer, where we really don't want people to have any clinical outcomes, and surrogate outcomes abound. And they're often quite confusing to figure out what they're talking about, progression-free survival, tumor relapse, that type of thing. And sometimes their relation to the actual clinical outcome is a little bit confusing. I'd say those are some reasonable examples.
You mentioned hemoglobin A1C, and you've said surrogates stand in for the outcomes that are important to patients. What is hemoglobin A1C standing in for?
When A1C initially became popular, it was because the A1C of patients with diabetes had a pretty fair and direct relationship to the chance of having a cardiovascular outcome. Maybe renal outcomes not as tightly, but the association with cardiovascular outcome was very good. Then the automatic assumption was, well, if I have a medication or other kind of therapy that I'm going to use to lower the hemoglobin A1C, you know, it would make sense that I would lower the chance of having those vascular outcomes. And around the time that a group of drugs called the glitazones came out, which would be about 20 years ago, 15 years ago now, when those trials came out, it was all based on the drugs came on the market based on the A1C, and then the clinical outcomes followed. These are arrangements that the companies can make with the FDA and Health Canada. And when the clinical outcomes came out, it turned out that actually the vascular outcomes, particularly MI, were even more common in glitazones than they were in the placebo in some cases. So it really threw into disarray the value of A1C as a surrogate. I think it was a very landmark example. We're a little bit more suspicious of surrogate outcomes because if they don't really predict all of the actions of the relationship with the clinical outcome, and they don't predict all the actions of the drug, which would be a very tall order to be involved in every part of the activity of a drug, then they're not going to perfectly predict all of the outcomes that occur.
You've mentioned hemoglobin A1C might be a surrogate. You've mentioned MI, and presumably cardiovascular death and stroke would be other patient-important outcomes for which the hemoglobin A1C might be a surrogate.
Right.
What about blood pressure? What's blood pressure standing in for?
Blood pressure is really interesting. It's relatively the same vascular outcomes primarily and renal outcomes. I think we've all known it, and virtually everybody accepts that an extremely high blood pressure over a long period of time is not a good thing to have. It's not particularly healthy. So the general idea of lowering blood pressure, one time when I started in medicine, it was relatively common to have patients where blood pressures were 200, particularly if they were older. The systolic would be 200, because the idea was this person had presumably an older circulation and could not tolerate the blood pressure lowering. And then the initial trials were done and showed quite clearly that vascular events, nobody concentrated on dementia at that time, but vascular events were less. So now the phase we're at is how low should the blood pressure be to get the optimal lowering of vascular events without having unusually high rates of acute kidney injury, for example, or falls related to low blood pressure. But general lowering of blood pressure seems to still be a reasonable surrogate for vascular events. And, you know, we just heard Dr. Youssef describe some of the polypill trials. So these are worldwide trials where he's saying that we should not throw out the baby with the bathwater. Now in North America, we're arguing about how low should the blood pressure be, 130 or 120. But think of all the areas of the world and many parts of our own country where blood pressure in many patients is still running much higher, and working on that higher level of blood pressure is very valuable for lowering vascular events, both heart attacks and strokes. And there is now, I think, some reasonable evidence that rates of dementia are affected as well.
You have mentioned that hemoglobin A1C did not seem to be a very good surrogate. There was a relation. People with higher hemoglobin A1C had more cardiovascular events. You lower hemoglobin A1C, it doesn't appear that the cardiovascular events go down, whereas blood pressure seems to have turned out to be a pretty good surrogate, in that as you lower your blood pressure, you do have a reduction in the events. Have I got it right?
There's some subtlety around the A1C. So it's a similar situation to blood pressure, I would say, in that, you know, it took a while to figure out how low the A1C should be. And particularly most of our diabetic patients are type 2. And it's been shown in several trials that an A1C too low, which generally is defined as less than 7%, you're not really going to get additional benefit, and you may get into more trouble with hypoglycemia. And those tend to be elderly patients with some underlying vascular disease. There's that issue. There's also the issue of the drugs that we use to treat the A1C with the hope that events are lowered. Depending on the drug or the drug family, that isn't always the case. There's sort of these two general issues around surrogate outcomes. You know, is the surrogate perfect throughout all levels of its measurement? And then the medications or the therapies we're using to treat the surrogate marker, does that have exactly and only the expected effect on the clinical outcome?
Does it have to be exactly and only?
Probably not. But you know what I've learned after all of these years, both as a clinician and somebody who helps all levels of government in drug policy, as new drugs come out, particularly in drug policy, we're always faced with, we don't know everything we need to know about the drug. Hopefully we know enough that we can go ahead and say, this is worth using, and we'll sort out the details later. I don't really think it has to be perfect. But I think where there's any significant concern, there's always a good impetus to please go on and actually measure the important clinical outcomes, and, you know, and hopefully in a randomized trial, as opposed to in observational studies where there might be some confounding.
Are there any disasters? In other words, times where you would have thought that reducing the surrogate or changing the surrogate would change the patient-important outcome, but it didn't work out at all.
Yeah, I guess it sort of depends what you would call a disaster. I would say there's very bad things happen clinically. And then in my own realm, there's other areas where the surrogate hasn't worked out and it's cost us a fortune and we've lost time getting other drugs to patients. The most famous example of using a surrogate outcome and it really probably eventually leading to significant harm in patients is the antiarrhythmic. You know, when I first started in clinical pharmacology, the lidocaine, procainamide, flecainide, sotalol, all of those were very, very commonly used. And for everybody that had ACS, acute coronary syndrome, it was quite common. If you saw a PVC or any kind of run, people would be on those medications because we knew that they calmed those events. We had telemetry evidence that there was calming of these abnormal beats. But in the end, as everyone knows now from those classic trials, when the proper studies were done, in fact, there was a higher rate of mortality in patients who were on many of those antiarrhythmics. That really changed practice.
That is one that I would describe as a disaster. The surrogate, if I understand what you've said, the surrogate was the asymptomatic, nasty-looking arrhythmias were eliminated very nicely with the drug. And you would have expected that the lethal arrhythmias would also be decreased, but they went in the opposite direction. And the drugs that got rid of the warning arrhythmias actually killed people.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a disaster. Any other examples that you can think of that sort of thing where it really is a problem in the way it worked out, that the surrogates were suggesting one thing and something different happened?
I don't think people would consider this quite so disastrous, but one of our concerns for treatments for rare diseases, they tend to be extraordinarily expensive. So if I think of Fabry's disease or others, you know, enzyme replacement, $300,000 a year, those are always listed, always brought to market, and paid for based on surrogate outcomes. And it is very common for those surrogate outcomes when long-term studies are done that they just do not pan out to be particularly helpful for clinical outcomes. In that case, it's not that the drug has been particularly harmful, but as I say, there's an opportunity cost to using medications that are extremely expensive where others would have done much more good in other situations.
Another example that comes to my mind is fluoride and bone density.
Fluoride, good one.
Studies showed higher bone density, less fractures. Fluoride increases bone density. They gave fluoride in randomized trials, and fractures were actually increased rather than decreased. So that was another one. Recently, drugs that HDL is associated with lower levels of cardiovascular risk, it was thought you'd raise HDL, and it should decrease cardiovascular events. Torsatrapib raised HDL nicely and increased events. I think that one of the reasons that people are appropriately cautious is that not only can it not work out the way you hoped, it can work out opposite the way you would hope. And that's led people to be cautious.
There's also some thought that, particularly in the cancer realm, there's been a lot of work done around the early approval of cancer drugs, which you can imagine is a huge issue for patients. If a drug is going to have benefit, get some decently good evidence that looks very good, you know, have the medication out there, but have it very tightly controlled to produce the clinical outcomes. That's the current paradigm. The concern is that once the drug's out there in practice, the practice actually changes. And if you study the medication effect in real practice, that initial signal of benefit is lost, but you're not actually testing it now in a randomized environment too. So there are very large areas where surrogate outcomes are used all the time. They're very important areas. We're actually pretty uncertain as to whether the surrogate properly predicts the important clinical outcome, I would say.
Early on, you equated outcomes that are important to patients and outcomes that are important to doctors as if they should line up completely. Do you think that's true consistently with respect to surrogates?
I'm pretty sure it's not true in my own practice. I wish it were more. I mean, I think most of us as clinicians ask our patients what's important to you, and then that becomes important to us. Of course, it's kind of a philosophical thing. But I can tell you in my patients with an opioid use disorder, you know, our approach to the outcomes that are important are they're somewhat different, or at least the surrogates that we're going to use to evaluate success. But, you know, patient important outcomes tend to be more around symptoms, function, quality of life. And depending on the age of the patient or the situation, there might be less emphasis on events because they seem kind of far off and potentially in some cases a bit nebulous. And for younger people, mortality may not be a huge concern. You know, as physicians, we're trained to have the long picture in mind and these important events in mind because we have a practice or a population view of what we're doing in healthcare as well.
Would you say that many clinicians and experts are still too taken with surrogates? They aren't as cautious as they should be?
Well, you know, Dr. Guyot, you would probably know that better than me because you have a wider probable audience where you would get that kind of feedback. In my own milieu, I would say in our practice area, I think people are fairly convinced that clinical outcomes are important. Just imagine where we'd be now in a pandemic if we could not actually measure COVID infections in some way. You know, if we had to rely on an imperfect surrogate to figure out if our vaccines were working. So I think in lots of situations, we have good examples where clinical outcomes have to be measured. And because we tend to propose or want to do very large, simple clinical trials, we're able to get those clinical outcomes more quickly. But I would imagine in other circles that people are still wedded to surrogate outcomes. And I don't want to suggest that surrogate outcomes, you know, we should throw out the baby with the bathwater. I think it's really just a degree of caution that's required is what is the quality of this surrogate outcome in terms of predicting the clinical outcome and helping us predict the effect of the therapy that we're trying to use to adjust to treat the disease.
Great examples and great referring back to your own clinical practice. I think people always appreciate that.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Holbrook has joined us today for this JAMA Evidence Podcast on Surrogate Outcomes from the JAMA User's Guide to the Medical Literature. You can find more of our podcasts at jamanetworkaudio.com, and you can subscribe and listen wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Once again, I'm Gordon Guyot, a professor of medicine at McMaster University and the editor of the User's Guides for the Medical Literature. Thank you for listening.